Call the case.
Case number SCWC 11512, Lopez versus State, arguing for the petitioner, Eric Seitz, arguing for the respondent, Kimberly Guidry, argument on merits.
Good morning, counsel. Are you both ready to proceed? Okay, we'll start with Mr. Seitz, and you're going to get a warning with 10 minutes to go for you, that you've reserved for your rebuttal, and then Ms. Guidry will give you a warning with 5 minutes to go. Please proceed.
Thank you. Morning. Thank you again for the opportunity to appear here. When I was last here a few months ago, we were arguing over the princely sum of $1,000 in bail money. Today we're arguing over big money, $3,000 in fees and a smaller amount of costs. But irrespective of the amount of money at issue, there are some very important principles, which is why we're here. In our view, if you accept and affirm the lower court's interpretation of the state means statutes, you then squarely face a constitutional issue, which I believe you can and should avoid. If, as the state argues, that the fees belonging to and earned by an attorney representing a state inmate can be seized to pay the inmate's child support obligations, not only will you be depriving the attorney, in this case me, of the fees, but you'll also be erecting an enormous barrier to access to the courts by those state inmates who will not be able to find lawyers willing to represent them for free. And that would violate the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution and comparable provisions of the Constitution of the State of Hawaii.
Would the same arguments hold true for tax liens, and would tax liens be unconstitutional under that theory?
I believe that they would, and I'm not aware, and we looked at that, I'm not aware of circumstances where fees paid to an attorney are taxed to the client.
But in a pre-existing tax lien against the client, an attorney then comes in years later to represent the client, and the attorney takes, or a ruling of the court is that the attorney's recovery pursuant to his or her lien is subject to the tax lien. Your position is that that tax lien or the statute providing for the tax lien to have priority would be unconstitutional?
Yes.
Mr. Seitz, you mentioned inmates would not have access. Wouldn't your interpretation go beyond inmates?
It could. It could. But in this case, we're talking about an inmate, and I would submit to you that there are many inmates who have child support obligations, obviously, because they're locked up and they're not making any money. And so it's a particular concern for that group of people who could not afford to hire lawyers in civil matters and for whom in this state we don't provide counsel through any other means. So I agree with you, it could go much broader than that, but in particular, that's a group of people who's affected, and we are among the only small law firms that would ever take these cases for reasons having little to do with the amounts of recovery, but nevertheless, we'd certainly like to get our costs back. And we, to be honest with you, have stopped doing that. Previous to this case, we never even asked a prospective client whether or not he or she had a tax lien, i.e. a support lien. We would never even raise that question. Now that that's come up, we do ask that question, and we have rejected cases because we can't afford simply to invest time and money in relatively small cases for which we'll never get paid. And I think that is the result and the consequence of these interpretations.
Have you ever reached out to the Attorney General's office to ask if they would agree to some form of distribution or split of the proceeds?
Yes. And We've done that in lots of different cases, particularly with Medicaid liens and other kinds of liens. And I've never had a health provider who has a lien not be willing to do that. In fact, the health providers are usually so grateful that you've obtained a recovery for them to the extent that you've been able to do so that they automatically deduct a third and then automatically will, or at least will consider deducting more. But they usually presume that a third has been earned by the attorney and that whatever else they can get, they're generous for. In this case, we did have those discussions. There was correspondence with the Attorney General's office over the imposition in this case of this lien, and they flatly refused, which is why we filed the motion in the court that we filed.
Do you think their refusal is based upon a lack of ability under the statute, or is it more of a position taken that they're just not going to negotiate? Do you know?
I afford to them the presumption that that's their interpretation of the statutes. No one said to me ever otherwise that we're not willing to be flexible in this situation. Basically, they said, we don't think the statutes allow us to adopt the position that you have indicated. And as you saw in some of the pleadings, They cited to a number of other circuit court cases which seem to have resolved this question, although we don't believe necessarily that it has been resolved. And again, you can avoid the constitutional issue, and I think it's entirely reasonable because we argue here that, those fees were ours. They were not the client's. They were never the client's. When we signed a contract with the client for a certain percentage of his fees, all the client had at that point in time was a claim. Once we resolved the case, in this instance with a judgment, that third was ours. It did not go to the client. And typically, as a matter of practice, when lawyers work on contingency fees, the fees are paid to the client and the attorneys. That's how the checks are made out. They go into the client's trust account by obligation, ethical obligation, and then we distribute the money. And so in this situation, I think it simply does not apply because the client never had a claim to our fees, and therefore, inferentially, the lien really should never have attached to our portion of the fees.
But, why would you need a lien if it...
No,
why would you need a lien if it was your property?
No, we don't need a lien. It's our money. It was our money. It was never anybody else's money. Now, let me just talk about two different situations just by comparison. If an attorney were to do work on a case on a contingency fee basis and then have a disagreement with the client and leave the case and assert a lien for the value of the work done, if and when that case is resolved and the attorney shows up and say, now I want my money, and there's a child support lien, if the money is coming out of attorney's fees that belong to the successor attorney, I could see that this same issue could arise. But if the attorney, the previous attorney, is asserting a lien against the client, then by all means, there should be a preference afforded to the child support lien in that situation because you have competing liens. But here, I start from the proposition there was really no necessity for any lien here. We didn't have a lien. That property was ours.
If that's true, why did the legislature use the phrase lien to describe the interest that the attorney has? In other words, you're talking about a perfected property right of the attorney in that recovery, and yet while that's a very definite concept and one that the legislature could have adopted in the statute, it doesn't appear that it did adopt it. Instead, it appeared to use the term lien, which really is a term of art that indicates sort of a priority or, in some sense, an unperfected, as yet unperfected interest, unless and until all the competing priorities are resolved. Why did it use the phrase lien to describe the interest that the attorney had?
I think that by interpretation, that use of the term lien should be limited to the kinds of cases I just analogized to, and not to this case.
Well, do you think the legislature thought about this situation when they promulgated this statute?
No, I don't think they did.
In fact, you cite to legislative history where the legislature said that attorneys' liens on settlements and judgment vest meaning I assume that attorneys have a specific right unto themselves with clear, and I assume the legislature meant unambiguous, property interests, so that the legislature enacting this statute recognized that there was a clear property interest that vested in the attorney as a result of the lien.
I believe that to be the history, and I believe that.
So would that intent be contrary to the strict interpretation of the statute?
I believe it would be, and that's what we've argued below. And yet, That intent would basically support the arguments that we're making here, that the statutory framework should be interpreted in such a manner that once that property became ours, it was ours and it was not subject to other liens.
Any the state makes the argument,
that
you can wait for your money. I mean, the justness of that argument aside, we can talk about how just that is. Your lien pertains only to the recovery, doesn't it?
Yes.
By virtue of that letter.
Yes.
And as a general understanding of contingency contracts, lawyers enter into contingency fee arrangements, usually because the client cannot afford to pay the attorney.
That's right.
So that there's no expectation, usually on the part of the attorney, and as a condition of the contingency fee, that if nothing is recovered, then the attorney recovers nothing in terms of his fees or his services.
That's correct.
And that even extends to costs and expenses, because I think it's general knowledge in the profession that if your client can afford to pay for your fees, he usually or she usually will not be able to advance costs and expenses. And if the case is lost, then the attorney absorbs the costs and expenses.
That's right.
So that if what has occurred here, the state, in effect, takes all of the money, they have, in effect, extinguished any reimbursement of costs and expenses to counsel and extinguished any recovery for services provided to the attorney.
Yes.
And if that is the result of the statute, then isn't it clear that the state has, in effect, extinguished a property right? And I think Black says, you know, lien is a property right that belongs to the attorney in violation of the 14th Amendment?
Yes, we made that argument from, there are two issues here. One is our rights, which we have articulated as well, and the other issue is the concern and the impact upon the clients.
Because you're not charging by the hour. If you were charging by the hour, then you would have set agreement with the client that they owe you that money forever.
That's right.
And so you can always carry that lien forward into the future. But a contingency fee arrangement is clearly different, and it doesn't survive that specific case, does it?
It doesn't survive that case. That's correct.
Because the recovery is only from the award.
That's
okay.
Right.
Okay. I would like to follow up. I think what Justice Acoba, I want to make sure I understand the implication of his questions to you. That means that you would have no right to place any sort of lien once the $9,000 is taken. That's it. You cannot come in either with a follow-up claim or even put any sort of lien or anything because any interest you had is gone.
I don't believe that I can do that. I mean, I could argue that I have an equitable claim against my client to sue him because he didn't tell me that he had a child support lien, but that's not going to go very far. For all intents and purposes, once we're not able to collect our portion of the judgment, there is no collection. And that includes fees as well as costs.
As a practical matter, as a matter of law? And doesn't the statute say you have the same rights and power over actions, suits, proceedings, judgments, decrees, et cetera, as the client has? So could you not seek to enforce your, if somehow you were left, say by mistake, the entire judgment was paid to the client who then spent all the money without you recovering your third, aren't there remedies available to you?
There are remedies in those situations, but for all practical purposes in this situation, there is no remedy. We lose our fees. But as I say, the other side of
that. Well, by definition, on a contingency fee contract, but your remedy is to get it from the award, right?
Yes, that's my only remedy. Now, let me just also just mention to you something else. There is an analogous line of cases, and regrettably, we only found these under the federal court access to equal justice statute. And the circuits are split on that. In those cases, some circuits have ruled that after a case goes to trial and the application is made for attorney's fees under the federal statute, that the fees can be attached for various purposes for liens, including tax liens and child support liens. Other circuits have said no, even though that application is made in behalf of the client, the money belongs to the attorney. And the latest of those was decided by the Eighth Circuit in 2008. Now, the Supreme Court has not decided. There's a clear conflict in the circuits. But I would submit to you that the mere existence of that conflict ought to suggest to you, as a matter of constitutional law, that we shouldn't have to go there.
But those are, you didn't cite those cases, I don't think.
I did not cite those cases. I'm sorry.
No, not.
I can provide them to you subsequently. We have them. There are about five such cases where circuits have ruled on the issue about whether attorneys' awards under that statute can be touched. But there's a difference as well. Because those are cases in which the application for fees is made after the award, after the case has been decided on the merits. And therefore, at that point in time, there is no property interest or entitlement of the lawyer comparable to what exists here. And yet, a couple of the circuits have ruled that that money is the attorney's for the same policy considerations, for the same constitutional reasons that I would argue that the decision here is mandated. Namely, we do not want to do anything to limit access of inmates or others to the courts, and if attorneys are going to represent people under these circumstances, we should allow them to be paid, that it's in everybody's interest.
But under your interpretation of the statute says that except for tax liens, prior liens of record on the real and personal property subject to the lien, the attorney's lien is superior to all other liens. Why would you even need that provision? If the intent of the legislature was to give the attorney an absolute property interest in his or her portion of the recovery, why would you even need a priority? Because as you pointed out, there would be nothing that would have priority over that.
I don't believe, as my first line of argument, that we do need that. I think the property's mine, and there really is no lien involved. But
that's what the legislature put in the statute.
I understand. But if that argument is not sufficient, then we go to the question of whether the lien statutes are ambiguous in any way. My suggestion is, based upon the language you read to me, that there is some ambiguity, and therefore you're entitled to interpret those statutes, and that you should interpret them in the manner in which I'm suggesting to you. And that's the second line, essentially, of argument. But I concur. I don't need that, because I believe this property was mine from the time that we won the case, and that portion that was to be paid to us for fees never vested in my client, and he never had an interest in that portion.
Well, whether or not you had a direct interest in the fees or not, or in the recovery or not, the lien itself is a property interest.
Yes,
correct?
It is.
So if it's a property interest, it's protected by the 14th Amendment. And we're not obviously bound by a specific federal statute as to recovery.
I'm just raising those by analogy.
Or the U.S. Constitution's due process clause.
I'm not sure I think about that.
Well, insofar as we can also rely on the Hawaii Constitution's due process clause.
To that, I certainly agree. Yes. I have nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Sumoto Gidry.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kimberly Gidry, and I represent the respondent, the state of Hawaii. Central to this case is the fact that a previously recorded CSA lien has superior priority over a later created attorney's fees lien. Both the CSA liens and attorney's fees liens are governed by statute. The statutory language is unequivocally plain and clear. Section 576D-10.5E, which governs CSA liens, clearly states that a CSA lien takes priority from the time it is recorded. Section 507-81D, which governs attorney's fees liens, states that the attorney's lien is superior except for prior liens of record on the personal property subject to the lien, that is, in this case, the judgment. Both statutes adhere to the common law principle of first in time, first in right, and CSA's lien is first in time. It was recorded in 1997 in the Bureau of Conveyances. Opposing counsel.
Is it common law? Is attorney's lien stem from the common law?
I believe they do.
And what about the doctrine of unjust enrichment? Stem from the common law also?
Yes.
Would there be unjust enrichment here where the state gets the benefit? I'm not sure. In this particular case, did the state pay the child support or in some way? Because this claim is for past child support.
Yes, that's true. And part of the money that's owed is owed to the state, actually the state of Washington in this case. But that is money that the state fronted to the custodial parent. So it's money that was actually used and expended for the welfare and the necessities for the child.
The monies went to the state because the state, in the meantime, had been providing support for the child?
Right. I think how it works in this case is that the state had fronted the money to the custodial parent. And so, therefore, in this case, the CSEA has a lien to recover that money that was fronted. That money was used, though, to pay for costs associated with the welfare of the child.
So, in fact, the state would be recovering monies it would not otherwise have had, I guess, this suit not been filed and recovery made.
The state is recovering money pursuant to the CSEA lien that
yes, but had the recovery not been made, that amount of money, $9,000, would not be subject to recovery by the state.
Not necessarily, because the CSEA lien statute authorizes the CSEA to recover the lien would attach to or would be satisfied to a broad range of real and personal property.
In this particular state, is the CSEA attempting to recover monies that it paid out or seek reimbursement for monies that paid out?
Yes, I mean that the money was rented to the custodial parent.
So if there was not money to lean on, then the state would not have recovered anything.
Yes, but the CSEA lien, like I said, it is satisfied by the CSEA lien statute authorizes CSEA liens to be satisfied by a broad range of real personal property that belongs to the obligor. So if the obligor were to come into money in the future, other types of money, the lien would attach to that as well. It just happens in this case that the lien would be satisfied through the judgment award.
So the state's position is that it can lien the monies recovered that were obtained through the efforts and expenditure of, I guess, actual costs and money by the attorneys without allowing for any compensation to the attorneys or recompense for monies they advance. And in fact, because you're claiming all of the monies, that would extinguish their right to expenses as well as fees.
I think perhaps, Justice Okoba, the best way that I can answer your question is to say that here there is one pot of money. It belongs to the judgment, to the plaintiff. The plaintiff was awarded a $9,000 judgment in this case. There are two competing liens. One is the CSEA's lien that was recorded in 1997. The other is the attorney's fees lien that was created at the earliest in 2008.
But for Mr. Seitz's efforts, would you have that $9,000 to lean on?
Go ahead and answer then.
What CSEA is trying to collect from is the $9,000 judgment that was awarded to plaintiff. It's plaintiff's money. There is a competing attorney's fees lien, but the CSEA also has a competing lien, and this case is purely about these competing liens. And the fact is, however plaintiff acquired the money belongs to plaintiff, and the CSEA lien is superior pursuant to the statutory language of 576D and 507-81.
As a matter of course, doesn't Mr. Seitz, what he says, you know, on workers' comp cases and other types of cases, doesn't the Attorney General usually cut one-third of to go to attorney's fees?
You know, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I can't speak to my office's policy because I do not know what the official policy of my office is. I know that in this case, we believe that the statutory language is so plain and unambiguous, and that the statute itself says, the legislature has said through the plain language of both statutes, that CSEA liens are superior, and also the legislature was adhering to the principle of first in time, first in right. The CSEA lien is a prior recorded lien, and that is why, in this case, it's entitled to superior priority.
Does the state monitor all civil suits to see whether or not plaintiffs have a lien filed, or is it more that this came to your attention because the person who happened to file it was an inmate in the facility, and therefore whenever anybody's an inmate, then it's drawn to your attention, and then you review it?
I do not know how it came about. It's not in the record how the state was made aware in this case that the lien exists, or that the judgment was awarded. It's my understanding that the CSEA has methods of checking into whether an obligor has money, was awarded a judgment. But again, I apologize. I do not know specifically in this case how the state was made aware.
Don't CSEA liens, don't you enforce them on tax refunds and all sorts of money?
Yes. Yes, CSEA liens are enforced on basically any type of real and personal property that plaintiff either has or subsequently acquires, and that's all authorized pursuant to the statute 576D-10.5.
Well, if we, Mr. Seitz argues that there is some ambiguity in the statute. I think he points at 756D-10.5F, and there's a passage there that talks about the withholding of the amount of the lien from the proceeds of any judgment or settlement due the obliger. So I think he suggests that sets up a distinction between funds that the debtor, I guess, in this case, or the obliger might be entitled to, and funds that the attorney is entitled to. And then based on that ambiguity, suggests we should look at the legislative history, which does refer to an intent to recognize property interests of the attorney in the recovery of the client. Now, what's your response both to the argument that there is an ambiguity and secondly to the significance of the legislative history?
There is no ambiguity. The state's position is that there's no ambiguity in the statute. The statutory language of both statutes is plain and unambiguous. To the extent that, the legislative history says that the attorney has a property interest, that property interest is in the form of a lien, and the attorney, the legislature intended for the attorney to have a lien interest in recovering his fees out of plaintiff's judgment. But again, there is no separate. Opposing counsel has no separate independent interest in an automatic recovery of the share of a share or portion of the judgment award. The judgment award is its plaintiff's property. The judgment itself specifically says that the judgment is awarded to plaintiff. What the attorney has is a fees lien on that judgment, and that lien is subject to the priority scheme that's set forth by the legislature in the statutes.
Would the legislature have produced a statute that would make an attorney's lien meaningless? Because if you take the 9,000 as you want to, that makes his lien meaningless. Was the legislature intending that the statute would encompass giving liens that have no meaning and no effect?
With respect, I don't think that's a fair way to characterize this, because the legislature.
What would be left of the 9,000 if CSEA is owed 23,000?
Based on the facts of this case, CSEA's lien would basically require the entire judgment award. In this case, based on the facts of this case, but there are other cases as well in many cases, a potential judgment award may likely be greater than the amount of the CSEA lien. And what the legislature was doing is...
In those cases, then the lien would not be meaningless, would they?
In those other cases?
Right.
No, but what
there would not be. But well, in but this case, it would
The lien isn't meaningless, though.
In this case, it isn't meaningless?
It isn't meaningless. It's the lien is a competing lien, and subject to the priority scheme set forth by the statute, CSEA lien has superior priority. The attorney still has, I believe, his claim for fees that's not extinguished by the fact that his lien wasn't given superior priority and is subordinate to the CSEA lien. But moreover, the CSEA lien was recorded in the Bureau of Conveyances in 1997, and the statute specifically says that prior recorded liens are superior. Opposing counsel could have or should have known of this lien because it was a prior recorded lien and it existed. What the legislature was doing was to create, within its complex and overarching priority scheme, a blanket rule that would apply in all cases to competing liens, irrespective of the particular facts of a case. That promotes certainty and ease of administration, and it's certainly a rational basis that supports the legislature's intent, and it's expressed in the plain language of the statute. To the extent that opposing counsel takes issue with the legislature's decision to give CSEA liens priority over attorney's fees liens, that's a policy decision for the legislature to determine. It's for the legislature to weigh policy considerations. The legislature has done so and has spoken on the matter. To clarify, the state is not at all making light of opposing counsel's policy arguments that, in his opinion, would favor according superior priority to attorney's fees liens. Our point is simply that opposing counsel's arguments are just that. They're policy arguments that are properly left to the legislature. And the legislature has already squarely addressed the issue by, in the plain language of the two statutes, according superior priority to CSEA's prior recorded child support lien. Finally, according superior priority to CSEA's lien does not violate opposing counsel's due process rights. Opposing counsel's substantive property right is to a lien interest in plaintiff's judgment. That lien interest is not an independent interest in a share of the judgment. 507-81, in fact, accords superior priority to prior liens of record. Moreover, opposing counsel's lien interest is not extinguished. Opposing counsel continues to retain a valid claim against plaintiff. Opposing counsel was not deprived of his property interest, that is, in the attorney's fees lien without adequate procedural due process. He filed a motion for writ of execution and mandamus in circuit court. That was briefed and argued. He thus had opportunity to be heard at a reasonable time and in a reasonable manner before the circuit court determined the superiority of CSEA's lien. There was no violation to plaintiff's due process rights to a plaintiff's access to justice, which I think is what opposing counsel was suggesting. There's no 14th Amendment due process violation. This is a civil case, and the plaintiff in this case happened to be a prisoner, but it was opposing counsel's choice to take this case on a contingent fee basis. The plaintiffs in civil cases are not automatically entitled to have an attorney represent them. To the extent that, opposing counsel is suggesting that the legislative policy of according superior priority to CSEA liens and having those liens paid first, that would deter perhaps in some cases, like cases where the facts are similar to this one, it would deter attorneys from taking these kinds of cases. It's a policy decision that the legislature has already determined and...
Do you know in this case, I believe Mr. Seitz indicated that he had reached out to the Attorney General's office to see if there was a negotiated resolution possible prior to the suit. In other words, an attorney might come in and say, I understand what the statute says, but if I don't take this case, you're not going to get any recovery. Would the state be willing to, despite its legal rights under the statute, allow me to recover one-third of whatever amounts I'm able to obtain? I guess my question is, I don't want to know if it's not in the record. Is that in the record? And
is not in the record. It's not in the record. There are letters going back and forth between opposing counsel and the state. However, I am not aware of negotiations as to perhaps opposing counsel receiving his attorney's fees and the state a lesser share. Despite the statute, I'm sorry, I'm not aware of that. And I don't know what my office's position would be.
You don't know whether your office has let me put it this way. Does the record reflect that your office has a policy of being willing to negotiate or categorically refusing to negotiate such questions?
I don't believe the record says anything on that. I know that the record includes circuit court decisions in which the state has or CSCA has pursued its right to recover CSCA lien monies.
That's after the fact. In other words, my question is, prior to the attorney taking the case, is there a policy of your office that's reflected in the record that your office will negotiate the possibility of allowing the attorney to recover some recovery in order to further the office's policies and interests and those of the agency, presumably by getting some recovery as opposed to none?
I do not believe that is in the record, and I do not know of my office's policy with respect to that type of negotiation.
Do you have any comments on the argument about this perhaps being an unlawful taking, either under the federal or state constitution?
I don't believe it's a taking because the legislature's priority scheme is very clear. It's set forth in the statute. CSCA's lien was recorded in 1997 in the Bureau of Conveyances. Opposing counsel was free to take or not take this case, and he could or should have been aware that there is this pre-existing CSCA lien and that would be subject to the priority scheme that's set forth in the statute. So therefore, he entered into this case or should have entered into this case with that awareness. I don't believe that there could be a taking under those circumstances. Moreover, I do believe that...
So the nature of the timing of the recording would determine the constitutionality of taking the attorney fees.
Well, the recording gives notice to the attorney that there is this pre-existing lien and pursuant to the statute that if there's a competing CSCA lien, that's in this case, it's prior recorded, and there's the attorney's fees lien that's later created, that certainly the CSCA lien pursuant to the statutory language and that would have superior priority. And it's not that the attorney's fees lien should not be satisfied. Perhaps, you know, in this case, because of the size of the judgment award, it wouldn't be satisfied out of the judgment itself. However, in many cases, you know, it could be that the CSCA lien is small, the judgment award is larger, and that the attorney's fees lien could be satisfied after the CSCA lien is satisfied pursuant to the statute. If your honors have no further questions, for all the reasons argued today and set forth in the state's brief, the state urges this court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Seitz, your rebuttal.
I really don't have anything else to say that would not be repeating myself, so unless you have additional questions.
What are the liens that are exercised by DHS when they pay medical expenses?
Yes.
Are those, is the statute any different in the priority scheme from CSEA liens?
There is no statute that makes, that gives them priority. And so as a routine matter, basically when we negotiate with them over those liens, they say, okay, reduce it a third because we're grateful for your efforts to collect money for us. And then we try to negotiate it further down. And in many instances, they're willing to do that based upon the amounts of the judgment, the circumstances of the case, et cetera.
So the difference is on DHS, there is no statutory priority, and in CSEA, there is.
Yes.
Mr. Seitz, I got a question. Knowing the fact that there was a, you were notified in on May 18, 2010, that CSEA was asserting its lien on your action, couldn't the court annex arbitration arbitrator render a order or a award bifurcating award to the plaintiff as well as attorney's fees and designating a part of that as being attorney's fees, given the fact that you knew that there was going to be a claim against whatever award that was going to be issued by the arbitrator?
That's a very interesting concept. You know, the other question, of course, is once we got that letter in May and the arbitration, I think, was in August, why we didn't withdraw. And we were certainly not about to do that, even though we knew the value of the case was probably not more than $26,000. But I think that's an interesting question. I will tell you, in only one experience that I've had similar to that, I tried a case in San Francisco where I knew the client was not going to pay me my portion of the fees when the check came. And in that situation, I specifically asked the judge to order the insurance company to pay the money into the court, and my portion was paid to me. But I don't know if we have a right to do that, or if an arbitrator certainly would follow that as a remedy. And nor do I know that even if we were to do it that way, that the Attorney General's position would be any different.
Well, wouldn't that be at least a clearer position?
It would be worth a shot.
Wouldn't, under your position, wouldn't you absolutely have a right to do that? It's your property.
I think so.
If under your position it's your property, you could tell the court, hey, you know, under the statutory scheme, this is my property, I ask you.
I think so. But typically, you know, in that level, arbitrators don't award fees. Hmm. We don't ask arbitrators to award fees in those kinds of cases. So I could see more likely doing that with a trial judge, for the reasons that I indicated. And I can think of one other reason, one other case in which I did here, where the client was not going to sign it, and basically we ended up interpleading the fees in court, and then the court paid out our fees.
Well, the state's position wouldn't make any difference, right? Because your fees are based on the recovery.
And the judgment, which they think is all theirs.
And the other thing is, didn't the state say, and you requested, or there was an agreement that there would be an interpleader action filed by the state, but the state didn't file it. And that's why you file your motion to execute on the judgment.
That is procedurally what it is.
So even the state wouldn't agree to that kind of structure.
And that's, as I say, I don't think the state's position would change even if we tried to go through that kind of a procedural mechanism. Thank you again.
Thank you very much to both our counsel this morning. The court will take this matter under advisement.